looking glass everywhere. People pissing on the stairs, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise. Got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back. Junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far. Cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Hello, Winter Park, and welcome to another edition of Punkonomics, broadcasting live here from WPRK, Winter Park, Florida, the voice of Rollins College, and the best in basement radio. And as a reminder, all opinions stated here today are solely ours and not of those of the working staff here at WPRK or of the Rollins College. Anyway, my name is Jesse Velez. I'm your co-host, and Dr. Balick is also here too.
Yep, that's right.
Yep, and the mic does work.
Works. Everything works. Great, great, great. We have actually a phone guest today. Well, we actually have a studio guest today. Jay Gordon's going to come in. I haven't seen him in a while. And actually, by his recommendation a while ago, we were trying to get a time where we can get together for a little chat with Frank Pasquale, who's a professor at the University of Maryland Law School and does a whole bunch of other things. And most interestingly, and you know, what started this all is this recent book of his, The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information. A very, very interesting and a little different book. So there we are. But that comes in, I don't know, about a quarter of an hour-ish or something.
Okay, that sounds good to me, too.
Coming in high demand. So there, we'll have time to wait. We have, let's help him. I mean, you know, my son's like lying on the sofa in the corner on his phone.
And you know, we covered, the whole alligator sex scandal, and, we didn't say whether the alligator was okay. The alligator was okay, so.
That's, last week, right?
Yeah, that was last week.
Florida man. One of those.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm getting things organized. Yeah, so what's going on, right? I mean, what, I suppose, to continue our conversation, Greek in a large sense, Greek capitulation. You know?
Yes. What happened with the Greeks?
Not Grexit, but, Greek capitulation.
Ah, I see. So they got a crappy deal.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's a hard game, you know, it's very difficult. Remember, when things are interconnected, such as, of course, in a common market, the whole point, if people play nasty, things get nasty fast. It was kind of expected once again, like the great financial crisis. There's a lot of shenanigans on the ground, as we talked about how most of this debt is actually hasn't been spent by the Greek government, but was actually covering banking losses. You know, Europeans were so proud of not having been played like we did in a direct and then indirect bailout of the banks. They put a nice chunk on the back of the Greeks. So there's a tremendous amount of interconnectivity like that. And they were in a position where they would have to really go, you know, off the grid, a bit radical, if the government would continue to hold its position and not capitulate. So they got a reasonably, yeah, they didn't even, frankly, they didn't even get the original deal. They were slapped around a little bit just to show them that next time anybody cares to say something, they better think twice before or we will hurt you because we own you.
It,
very
you know,
ugly stuff. Very ugly stuff.
It's amazing they're having that kind of power, you know, sitting back. Cause they knew they were going to do it anyway. They knew they were going to bail out Greece. It took them so long. They just wanted to just let the Greeks know that they're sitting up there. And I wonder how much more money they're going to steal on top of it. Jay. Hey, this Jay Gordon in the house.
Exactly.
Long time, Jay.
So we're chewing the fat a little bit about the Greek capitulation before we call Frank Pasquale at 2:30. But yeah, I mean, you have to see all the politics, like Nikos Varoufakis and Yanis Varoufakis that specifically said in a little, you know, confirmed at least one of the correct conspiracy theorists about it, theories about it, that it's a message to France, for example. It's an important message to France. To be careful not to change politics, you know, to stay in line with the financial elites of Europe, but not to allow any kind of populism. But of course, and of course, who's happier the most are the neo-Nazis in Greece, because they're like, they're set. All they have to say is remind people, you know,
of how
wouldn't have been such beeps.
That's right.
And they'll get probably a nice representation. And anyway, I mean, you know, it's I predicted that in the '80s, you know, that we shouldn't be always, we should, of course, be concerned with neo-Nazis, fringe right parties, because they're a pretty hateful bunch. But, but their main part, the real danger is where the main parties are floating into their, you know, electorate and positions in order to gain votes.
I'm sure the details are not out yet, but, does it look like it's going to help them out, or are they just going to stay in a coma and then go further down the rabbit
Greece?
Hole?
Yeah. Catastrophe. Mm-hmm. There's no way this
There's no way they're going to come out.
Hey, wait, do you want to take the conspiracy? I mean, I say quote-unquote conspiracy because this is quite understood and agreed upon by most people. Actually, it's not such a big deal in any sense, but it sounds like conspiracies are the norm today. It's also a kind of a fight. A big signal here was to America, because, in fact, the IMF reviled accurately for being an instrument for financial exploitation and ruin of the poor world, you know, and when good people came to the IMF, they typically quit, you know, that's how it happens, you know, and many people have, so it's actually almost a conversion mail, but never mind. So the IMF is reviled for how it entraps third world countries in a debt trap that doesn't cause development, that keeps them poor, miserable, and dependent, you know, and then politically under control, et cetera, et cetera. That's a whole topic. We touch upon it often. You know?
Right,
that's
right.
The imperialism version three, if you will. But doing it within Europe is another matter. So Ukraine even comes to the picture. You see Germany, Poland, which is very much, a lot of the East European countries are very much on Germany's babies. They see where the butter, where the bread is buttered, shall we say. I get it. Nothing, you know.
They left a couple cousins after the Second World War.
I'm Slovak, you know, my nationality. They're pretty right. No, I can't say the B word, can I? I mean, well, illegitimate child word, can I? I don't even know, right? There's no, that's the thing. I mean, right, they keep us on toes. It's like 1984. There's no real list of words that you can't say. There's a great, you know, comedy skits about it, like George Carlin.
Of course.
But there is no list, right? So it's in context. So somebody gets away, it depends.
That's only a matter of taste, and it depends on whose taste.
It's almost like putting a dampener a little bit on conversation. But at any rate, so it's against America. IMF is really in American control. When people are you know, bitching and moaning about America around the world, you know, the imperial policy, the Washington Consensus, that's because the IMF and the World Bank are basically American organization, if international organization. So when the IMF decided to be a little bit more reasonable with Greece in the last minute, and there was even a leak, who knows, leaked voluntarily or not, you never know with these bodies, but timing seems funny, of a report that the IMF said already in 2010. And again, we're talking about the chief rapist of the world, right? Saying like, wait a minute, this is going to really just completely destroy the Greek economy. We're not sure we're on the right path here. After all, it is a member of the European Union, so you're responsible for them. In some sense, the cynic entertainment guy in me, so I'm being a little over the top as usual for any new listeners there, you could see that as a push against Washington, clearly. That's not the weird bit about it. That's clearly a thing. The IMF does not call the shots who we rape and destroy economically in Europe, right? And it puts a question, you know, it puts a completely different picture on the collaborative process of Europe. I mean, it's a different Europe than the one envisioned when I was an undergrad in the 80s, you know, people kind of put it together, got the people riled up behind it. There were a lot of complications. But yeah, you know, the banksters are in charge of Europe. That's the shortest possible way of saying
it. Let's see how gradually they go down the hill.
Power is power, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's not like, shouldn't surprise anybody, really. You know, I mean, when power concentrates, what do you expect it to do? In that sense, Marx was extremely right. One could point to people before him who pointed to similar things. Marx maybe made it into a fully fledged, complex economic model. And others with different political persuasions have shown similar situations to it. All ties to the great big cluster B.
Yep.
Everything's interconnected, so it's not easy. Even if there is a solution, you have to apply multiple solutions at the same time.
It also makes me wonder who's the next on the chopping block as far as asking for a deal like that.
Well, in some sense, I mean, you know, it depends. To some extent, they're postponing a class dimension a little bit by telling German workers, don't worry, you guys are great, you know, wonderful, Aryan. Oops, sorry. Really, it's nothing personal. I love Germany, don't get me wrong. I would, and some German workers, in fact, have realized that they're down somewhere on the list. Maybe we'll gut Greece first, maybe Portugal too, maybe Ireland, hell, maybe even Italy. But you're coming. So there is actually a movement against austerity everywhere. In some sense, there was a shot, you know, a very big kind of do not start with us.
Even as bad as it failed before?
Well, the fail, of course, once again, that's a bit one of the questions, right? How does, what exactly, how do we define failure, first of all? And for whom, above all? So the situation in Greece was really bad. It's not going to get any better. And the sheer cynicism of it is something that anybody who kind of really honestly tried to tackle economic development of the poor world, often ex-colonies, etc., and or East Europeans, so transition from communism, have found how difficult and complex these processes are, and seeing it and how much, you know, there's good intentions in it, but there's also a tremendous institution. The big picture is still colonialist, exploitative, and the flow of the trillions from the poor world every year and the trickle to the other side.
Right.
So we're actually still, it's not like we're not helping them. Often well-meaning students will say that, but can we help them more? Do we help them enough? I mean, you're not even helping them. I mean, there's some nice, you're funding some good people doing good stuff. Sure. Yeah. Even the UN does a lot of good stuff, by the way. It's the biggest do-gooder out there, whatever people think about it in other senses. Yeah. But the system itself is rigged. Completely.
Yeah, it's rigged for failure.
If you think, if Americans are beginning to wake up today and find out that maybe it's rigged for them, imagine how rigged it was for people living in the poor colonial world and still continues to be. You know? Imagine. So in some sense, they might postpone that in Europe, but there's that cannibalism that we see all over happening there. It could be seen as that. We're eating up one of our limbs in order to survive. We, I say, as if I have any key in that. I don't get invited to Davos, which is mediocre skiing resort with a lot of very fancy places.
Hey, Jay is happy. What did you just finish eating, Jay?
Yeah, they ate something nasty that came in a plastic
bag. Oh, yeah, that pilgrimage.
Every time you remind me of Breaking Bad when you bring the Los Polos Romanos or something there.
Oh, yeah.
The packaging, you know.
Yeah.
Like.
So tell us a little bit about this guest that we're getting today, yeah. Jay.
Frank Pasquale wrote this interesting book called The...
He's got it in hardcover.
In a hardcover.
Yes.
Ooh, that...
I only have a Kindle.
Called The Black Box Society. I bought this one direct from Harvard.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So you're funding the man, too.
Yeah. So it's a pretty... it's a pretty interesting book. About the nature of passing over control to particular algorithms and the pernicious effects that it kind of has on society. So that's what he talks about.
Hold on. We're going to have to navigate a little bit between, and I think, you know, it could be actually interesting. I mean, like you said, algorithm.
Right.
So I did notice on some of the things I watch, right? So it's just a series of instructions. It's often associated with computers, but it existed before. It's a kind of a mathematical concept that could even be a cooking recipe, right? A series of precise instructions. You follow that to do the outcome. So think about that. What happened when you're with your search entry into Google? How do they figure out what websites to bring you out? Obviously a little bit more than a recipe. But same principle.
Right, same principle. And yeah, he talks about the effects of algorithms, the pernicious effects of algorithms on our day-to-day lives in terms of things like, say, search or even reputation. So one example of this is, say,
shopping.
One example of this is, say, the personalized search that everyone likes. You know, he says, look, you know, there are pretty good things about it. For example, my cousin gave me a recommendation on some computer programming language called Solr. And
how often do they come up with that? I mean, but they're all similar, right? That's right. The idea. So it does have.
It was a corporate search thing called Solr that his company GE was messing with, and he said, "Hey, go ahead and play around with this." And I didn't know how it was spelled because this was phone conversation, and I typed it in. And I got the programming book, so personalized search is kind of great for that. So instead of, say, solar panels or what have you, you know, I got the programming book. I got it from my favorite publisher, so I was like, yeah, we're good to go. But it's pretty bad when you're looking for something else. So if I am looking for say, the essay where John Stuart Mill outlines syndicalism, or if I'm looking for the section of Hayek where he talks about having a minimum income or basic income or what have you, it's what I get is Noam Chomsky quoting Hayek or Noam Chomsky quoting Mill, and I don't get the actual work itself because Google's personalized search, you know, says, oh, look, you like Chomsky, you're a communist. So I got all of these left-wing commentators who are quoting, like, right-wing thinkers when I actually want to read the right-wing mm-hmm. thinkers myself. So personalized search kind of puts you in that.
And literally selecting, I assume, even if you manage to plow through that and find the kind of the stuff you're looking for. That is often known, I think, when people talk about social networking, right, as the echo chamber thing. So that you hear people that you already know, that know people you know, etc., and you never get the opposing side.
Right. So, yeah, it, you know, those kind of things can put you, it, you know, it's great as a marketing tool, but you also have this effect of where it puts you in a bit of an echo chamber. And speaking of social media, I got off almost all of it cold turkey. No more Twitter.
Yeah, right. It has to be said that, you know, right, the guy who quoted Ted Kaczynski on this show 2 years ago.
Yeah. No more Twitter, no more Google
No
Plus.
No iPhone, right?
None of that.
What, you know what? Let's even, like, we have a minute probably, right? Let's go into a complete, what's up with him? What is he doing now? He's writing stuff? I mean, I've seen, like, recently people, of course, funnily enough, that Unabomber guy, right? The most famous Luddite in the world. Kaczynski, right? I mean, did some, he was no fool, right? He was a serious mathematician. And some things he got right. I mean, I doubt that by, you know, turning himself into some kind of nutter in a cabin thing, he actually did much to, of anything useful, but
well,
he's better to keep writing, you know?
Yeah, he did, allegedly.
He's in jail, isn't he?
Yeah, he's in jail.
He's still in jail.
Yeah, he did allegedly, kill some CEOs.
Right.
Well, yeah.
There's the
who are destroying the environment.
You know, the only place I allow for cosmic, stuff to happen in my life is when my t-shirt happens to exactly fit. Isn't that the coup song? One of the old songs, right? 50 Ways to a CEO. Good band, the coup.
Right. So, yeah, he did do that, but yeah, I mean, I finished up,
yeah,
technological slavery.
Yeah.
I had it on my Amazon Swindle.
Swindle.
Yeah. Swindle out of your books. Swindle authors too.
Yeah.
But then I got it on hard copy and I started reading it again and I finished reading it and it was a pretty interesting book. I definitely liked the
read bits of it, so
I especially like going off in the cabin part, because he actually talks about how the mountains of Montana were giving him everything that he basically needed and how he was living.
I'd have a very hard time, you see, because I need something to give me, you know, my Steam account, extremely high, low ping rates, and a fast internet connection.
Well.
And access to major gaming realms, you know. When
yeah.
I have a little time, otherwise I'm all past my life on Google Docs, of course, writing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of used to that because my parents back home just live so far out that I don't even get a consistent internet connection.
Well, for a short
bother.
Period of time, like, yeah, I can see the therapeutic kind of ashram nature of that.
My folks don't even know what the internet is.
I don't even bother, so I just bring a book.
But going out off really significantly is a big sacrifice on multiple levels, and of course, I mean, we shouldn't burn out. Well, we'll figure it out. You guys help me out. I'm old and rather exhausted, quite frankly, because I have the house filled with guests and, you know, on the floor. And, some of them on the floor and the dogs and the cats and, lots going on and I'm not getting much sleep. Look at Felix is in the corner there, kind of thinking of catching a quick nap.
Yeah, you look so refreshed. Why is that?
Well, I'm just, I enjoy this show too much and I'm looking forward for this interview. So I don't want to burn out the big questions because Pasquale himself, he's actually has a very, if anything, maybe we'll find him calling him too moderate about the idea that this could be addressed to some extent, though I'm really very big on a thousand flowers, letting a thousand flowers bloom. Everybody tries to look, do it their own angle.
Yeah, I think I might push him on that a little bit because, I'm not quite sure that I'm a big fan of his solutions, but I will say what makes the book.
I'm sure it'll work.
Don't scare him, Jay.
I will say that what makes the book worth it is that he outlines the problem, at least for me, really, really well.
Yes. Absolutely.
So,
in ways you haven't kind of thought about it. I mean, in the broadest sense, I mean, again, we'll be, well, I should multitask and give, I said 2:30, it's going to be 5 more minutes, I can't wait. But no, very interesting. He gave some interesting talks. He's also on YouTube and stuff like that, so you can catch up a little bit. He's getting attention for it because he's dealing with the processing side of all the mass amounts of information that's being accumulated. And the massiveness, some people are becoming a little bit more aware of just how massive. So he also, enumerates nicely for us where people are getting information. Sometimes you don't really realize how much detailed information about your life you get through your basic shopping needs and basic activities. But his niche really is looking about what's the effect then when that data is processed to some extent from things like what the search engine gives you to what, shopping, stuff, what websites, recommend to you, think about how amazing, let's give them a plug, Pandora were. Now they have different competitions. But in their algorithm, here's an example of sophisticated algorithm that looks at what you're listening to, what you like, what you dislike, and comes up with what it thinks you might like next time.
It also could be a negative too, as far as, algorithms, because there was a while there, where travel sites and several other sites were actually charging Mac users more money.
Oh, well, yeah. Right. That's excellent. He writes about stuff like that in the book. There's a lot of stuff about exactly like that. Right?
Yeah,
because you were tagged by having a Mac. You being a Mac user, you're tagged overall average statistically higher income.
I know. It is,
for example, willing to buy maybe low, what we call, low elasticity of demand. You'll buy that overpriced shiny piece of metal no matter what it costs.
I thought it was a conspiracy or some kind of a rampant joke, and I was booking a flight to back home to San Francisco, and for some bizarre reason I walked away from the computer, and a friend of mine had his laptop on of a PC, and I said, man, these prices are just way too high. And he says, really? You got to be kidding. Which side are you looking at? Expedia, Travelocity, all that. He gets on Expedia, same flight, about $150 less.
Yeah.
And my screen was still up. We're going what's going on here?
You can get tagged for different things. The book also talks a little bit about that notion where they, it's not really discrimination because they gauge it differently. I mean, they're collecting information that would be discriminatory if it was kept the same way, but if you're just calling, client's propensity to invest in high-end overpriced shiny products, that's not an hate crime to charge you more.
Yeah, he says that when it's presented as a sort of an opinion, instead of a fact of the matter, it's very difficult for consumers to protect themselves. But I think this is why I think the and we're getting ahead here, but I think for me the reason why the solutions are too moderate is because there is the assumption that we can trust corporations and government to do better, and what I tend to think is that these technologies are far too there's a point where I just think that they're far too costly, and you just have to get rid of them. Richard Stallman is a bit of a Luddite like that. So he created the free software movement and GNU, and he doesn't carry a cell phone at all, and he only purchases things with cash, except airline tickets. Because, he argues that a lot of these technologies are, number one, proprietary. And because they're proprietary, they're malware. So they're built to exploit people who use them. They don't provide any benefit to exploit people.
Well, one of my, and I won't forget to ask this again, and I'm sure, I mean, we could hopefully develop it because it's very interesting for me what Francis Galati has to say about this also, is that it's an old economic question, it's the ownership of this, of the property rights. I mean, it's really kind of a bipartisan in a sense. I'm looking at the ownership of, you know, who owns the means of production on one side, though perhaps today we're talking about the means of reproduction, the digital technology. And that sounds right out of Karl Marx, but then I'm talking about a possible solution being well-established property rights. Again, I'm talking beyond the political mangle, which is another layer of problematics. How do you even break through the leadership? Yeah. But you see what I'm saying? Where, yeah, you're like, I agree with you. You can't stop it by adding layers like that, but you can look at, you know, who owns and manages their data. If it is us, then we can retain the conveniences.
Well, there are two. So I think for Stallman, at least, there's really one solution with this data, and that's to make it free, mm-hmm. meaning that the users can not mm-hmm. only do things like see the source code, but modify the source code.
Yeah.
They can go ahead and share it. They can do all of that kind of stuff. So he has a very radical view of transparency where it's open and the users can see it and the users can be educated about it, so it's not obfuscated by things like complexity, right? Mm-hmm. So as Assange makes a point really well in Cypherpunks, he argues that it's good to have it's good to have transparency, but at the same time, the more transparency opens up, complexity can increase.
But they also write in the Cypherpunk the WikiLeaks manifesto. You can say their slogan, right? I mean, the transparency for the powerful, and privacy for the weak. So you have to go both sides.
Right.
Of course, I mean, yeah, just opening everything up, it also depends on some kind of democratic attention. You can just, as a Mac user, I just handed them an Android.
Yeah, it's these PCs.
You had to. You gave it to me on a platter, right? Sometimes the double or the middle button there. Yeah, we're getting ready to call on our landline with a mic pointing in its direction. Frank Pasquale, eh? Let's see what he has to say about it and take
Did
it from
my
there.
Friend's notes help? Did my friend's notes?
Oops. Oh. I don't know if you're listening to it, but well. Oh, now that our phone's gone nutters. That's possible. Make strange beeping sounds. Well, at worst, you use mine. I mean, it's pretty good quality. Well, down here, well, we'll find out. I got Wi-Fi on. We're in the basement. We really are in the basement, in case you don't know. WPRK is in the basement. Eventually, but even then, it's difficult with pretty weak signal here. Mm-hmm. Usually, that's really weird that it's not working.
No, I mean, if you're on Wi-Fi on that.
Barely. Okay, well, let's look at it. You know, I don't know. We play a tune real quick or something?
We can always play a tune real quick.
See what's going on. Try and repair. Yeah, that's a normal number.
This is Rock and Roll Radio. Come on, let's rock and roll with the Ramones. Let's go.
Hey, this is Mr. Cadnet.
And Fox Force 5.
And you're listening to
WPRK, Winter Park, Florida.
All right, welcome back to Punkonomics. Little technical difficulties there with the phone. We know how to use computers, but we don't know how to use the phone. You know, that's what's happening nowadays.
Yeah, I haven't had a landline in many, many years. We have with us Frank Pasquale. We've been talking behind his back already just a little bit, saying generally very nice things, though.
Well, thank you.
Lovely to have you on. I want to launch right in. Did we say you're Law Professor at University of Maryland? I believe we did. We will also be, post a little bit of extra, probably link here and there once we cut it into a podcast and let you know about it, so that you can use it any way you want. But tell us a little bit about maybe yourself as you professionally came to be interested in this material and then, you know, what your summary of it is.
Sure. Well, thanks so much for having me on. And I would say that the way that I got into this material, this book covers a lot, and it was written over several years, but the very start of it was I was just beginning as a legal academic. I practiced law for a few years in the intellectual property area, and I was connected with some folks that were doing a conference on search engines. And at this conference on search engines, this was 2005, it was a big celebration of them. Everyone seemed to believe that, you know, we were finally going to beat back the big bad recording industry and the MPAA and free content for the people, etc. And I thought in many ways it was a positive development to have things like Google, other search engines out there. But I was also suspicious, and I kept a lot of notes during it, and then I went over my notes and just started writing about the people who were sort of left behind by search engines and the people that, you know, had trouble with them, people whose sites were disappeared, people who couldn't get their ads online, other things like that. And that was a series of articles, probably about 100,000 words of articles on that stuff. And then I met this really inspiring privacy scholar in 2007 or so, named Danielle Citron. And she works on these things called fusion centers, or she was working at the time on fusion centers, which are ways where the state brings together all this different data from different sources, including data from search engines. And we wrote an article together on that. And those were the two sides of the book, chapters 2 and 3, where it talks about search and it talks about reputation. But the book really all came together, though, for me after the financial crisis of 2008, because at that time, you know, I just was so mystified by the fact that, you know, a few mega firms on Wall Street could just crash the whole economy. I wanted to understand that, and so I just started spending all my free time, like, trying to read books on finance and understanding it and reading the Financial Times and Naked Capitalism, these other sources, and the sources they pointed to. And, you know, and that sort of made me feel like a lot of the problems that me and other legal scholars were looking at in the search engines and the privacy context, those weren't just firms being bad. They were firms acting in a system, and that system is largely a financial system. You know, the finance side of things is really driving things, and law and policy is a bit of an afterthought. So the book is an effort to turn that upside down. The book is an effort to sort of bring finance under the control of policymakers and law, and hopefully from that standpoint, bring the internet economy to a similar level of accountability.
Of course, I mean, we can't, yeah, that's great. I mean, we cannot, but our characteristic Punkonomics way of jumping like right to the end almost in a second is, the problem is, of course, that the governments are mostly under the control of the financial system.
You're right, and there's a huge problem of circularity, and I mean, I do address that in Chapter 6. I say, you know, that's the first problem. The first problem has to be to understand that essentially, you know, and there's so many areas where that's happened. However, I mean, there are also, you know, really thick, good books like Preventing Regulatory Capture that Daniel Carpenter edited. You know, that book is 500 pages of recommendations on how you stop the corporations from controlling the you know, agencies and regulatory branches. So, you know, I mean, I do think that you're right to say that's got to be acknowledged, but the flip side of it has got to be that, well, we have to have some agenda for empowering agencies. And just one really good example of that is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is self-funding. So they don't have to worry about offending some giant bank and then having that bank running to Congress and cutting off their money and firing the people at the CFPB. they get their funds out of a percentage of levies on banks, you know, from the Fed, I believe. I mean, I don't know the exact details as to that funding, but it's definitely, it's kept a bit further out of the political process, which I think is a very good thing.
Yeah, I know. Jay? You know, don't want to monopolize. We don't have you here often. And you didn't, you know, you did give me this book.
Oh, yeah.
So thank you for it.
Okay, hey, Mr. Pasquale. I guess we can go right into it. So in the intro, you write here about three ways that we can keep or corporations keep black boxes closed, right? You have real secrecy, legal secrecy, and obfuscation. If you wanted to do so, could you give us some examples of that?
Yeah, so in terms of the three approaches that corporations take, the first being sort of just keeping things secret, like real secrecy, keeping things under lock and key, and having incredible abilities there. And I mean, my one comment there too about, you know, the relative power of corporations versus government is to look at how many leaks happen now of government entities like WikiLeaks, others, versus, like, you know, where's the Goldman Sachs leak or the Bank of America leak, et cetera. You know, it's kind of amazing to think about how the military seems more vulnerable in some ways than the major financial institutions. The legal secrecy side of it, I think, is more important for a lot of entities that, say, want to keep you from copying their trade secrets or reverse engineering them. So, you know, for example, a firm like Google, some of these other firms, you know, they will, when you use them, you've got to agree to terms of service whereby you're agreeing that you're not going to be automated, doing an automated download of all sorts of Google search results, in part to keep their quality up, but also in part to protect their intellectual property. And also, people on the inside sign these things. So, you know, some people ask me, well, who did you talk to at Google about this sort of stuff, or how much work did you do inside of Google? And, I mean, I've been there. I've been to their New York offices, and I've talked to, you know, lots of people. But you have to remember that, like, the people in the firm sign these non-disclosure agreements, NDAs, and they can't say anything. You know, so that's like legal secrecy. It's when somebody has to sign an agreement and they know that if they breach that, they could lose their entire livelihood, you know, in a lawsuit for the value of the trade secrets that they disclose. The third is the most interesting to me, in a way, is I call it obfuscation, which is using complexity to keep things too complicated for people to understand. So, you know, there are some Wall Street deals where you have a contract that's 120 pages for an investment, and that refers to 25 other contracts that are 120 pages that each refer to 25 other contracts that are 120 pages. And, you know, it's sort of exponential murkiness. and, you know, that is increasingly, that is the world that these entities present to us. And this is actually also a part of the theory of, Tim Jordan has this wonderful book out called Information Politics, where he talks about the recursiveness of these information structures. And the key to their power is that they can sort of create these recursive structures that are so complicated no one outside can understand them. And when that happens, then they, you know, whatever the result is, they always say, oh, well, that was just the computer did it, you know, but that is a way for the people at the top to disclaim responsibility.
You're right. I mean, it's interesting that I even had a tiny bit of research years ago in antitrust, and we saw how the game theory is not applied in any sense, and a lot of the arguments were precisely for mergers and acquisitions based on that we can't really determine that this is be damaging to everybody except for the board of directors. So then the trade committee couldn't do anything with that, based really on a ruling. To me, it was my lawyer friend actually enlightened me that this can be a ruling with, oh, it's just too complicated, so we'll let these two giant monopolists merge.
Yes, and you know, antitrust is a fantastic example of that. I mean, it's not a big part of my book, but I mean, I have been really amazed at the way in which you have over the past, say, five decades, thanks to the Chicago School, you have this mantra that only consumer welfare is to be measured, not effect on competitors, in antitrust lawsuits in the U.S. And this has led to, but of course, consumer welfare, I mean, really, that could be such a capacious term. But in order to discipline the term, ostensibly in order to discipline and make it rigorous and make it capable of calculation and expert assessment, they essentially knock out incredibly important aspects of human experience. So, like, C. Edwin Baker's work on media monopolies. You know, you can have an analysis of media monopolies that is, says, oh yeah, it's incredibly efficient to have all the media provided by one company, you know, because it can really maximize profits. It'll have monopoly, you know, these different things. And I think that's problematic because it ignores the effect on diversity of viewpoint. It ignores the effect on minority communities. It ignores so many big effects. And what I see, actually, I do mention antitrust in the book in the search engine part where I talk about, you know, there's, in the U.S., Google has had a fantastic run of success in antitrust lawsuits, and it's largely because the federal policymakers say, oh, you know, everyone seems to like what they're getting on Google, not realizing or just ignoring the fact that if you allow Google to sort of become, you know, when you search for weather, the weather result is like this giant page of just Google weather. Well, that destroys the incentive to innovate alternative methods of presenting the weather or, you know, and I see it even, this is just a pet peeve of mine, but I think it's, you know, a useful example. You know, I try to find out, like, the humidity, like, because to me, the day, the heat doesn't really matter as much as the humidity in Baltimore often. I can never get that. I mean, I don't get it, you know, I don't get it served right up to me, but it seems like the most obvious thing that, you know, Google Weather ought to be giving me. But, you know, and I feel like there's probably some upstart that has this brilliant way of presenting what the weather actually feels like, but it's being squeezed out by the information intermediaries that just, you know, are trying to make themselves monopolize the prime screen space whenever people ask questions.
No, and that's fundamental, of course. I mean, this lack of competition is a major aspect of many of our economies and here too, and especially if this is indeed as it might be shaping into an information age, for better or for worse, it becomes particularly important, and who owns it? Who controls it? Who has property rights to it?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So actually, what I did after I read this book, I think the next book I read was I know that you mentioned Nicholas Nassim Taleb here, it wasn't a very fond mention, but his book, his new book at least, Anti-Fragile, talks about some of the issues of complexity and its asymmetric effects. Especially when it fails, right?
And systemic, like I was saying before, about the fact, right, that it changes.
So, and in the book, I think he pointed to a piece of historical research, that, you know, I just think that our listeners might find interesting and you as well, on mergers. And the research concluded throughout the history of the mergers that were done that none of them were helpful. And almost all of them were catastrophic to the economy, because of the largeness and the scale and the complexity of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a wonderful point. And I mean, I think that you're, it's funny because the mergers do work, but they work for a very small elite at the top of the firms, and they especially work for the firms that get, prepaid as a percentage of the deal. And, you know, that's what I think is, it never gets reported really, like what's the take of the people at the top and the take of the firms that are merging the two. And sometimes the take can be just outrageous. I mean, we're talking about if the people in the banks were paid by the hour getting $10,000 an hour for, you know, for the ways that they're bringing together these companies and then breaking them apart. And, you know, that's the other thing that I think is so critical about the merger aspect, and this is something that is a leitmotif of the book, but that I am trying to really publicize in future work, is what's the relationship between these financial moves of merging or demerging, spin-offs, whatever it is, and the real economy? Because it's so much easier for these executives to almost like with a cookbook recipe, you know, let's get taken over by somebody and that'll raise the stock price, then my options will go up, et cetera. It's just this incredibly easy way to run off with a paper profit and a profit for the person and big compensation for the person that arranges it, but not to improve the actual operations. You know, and I would love to see a study of like the airline industry and look at how many times, you know, through their mergers and other financial engineering, people have gotten enormously wealthy, but the experience of the average passenger is increasingly chaotic, horrific.
Yeah, you know,
at least for me. I mean, I'm very tall, and I can say that, you know, it hurts to fly a lot nowadays. So,
if I can cut in, I'm a former airline person who've gone through like three mergers. And I gotta say that it's not just the consumer. Actually, the consumer falls in line with the CEO and some of the other people who are raking in the money.
It's down peasants anyway.
It's the actual employees, the ones that wind up suffering and taking the pay cuts, which translates into savings to the customers, believe it or not.
Well, you know, it's there's a really interesting debate. I totally agree with you about the efforts to squeeze the employees, and I'm very sympathetic with the how problematic that is for everybody, you know, all along the line. But there is really interesting discussion by Doug Henwood on his Left Business Observer and some and his blog there on the degree to which there has actually been consumer welfare via the direction of the airline industry over the past, you know, several decades. I know that the established economic point of view is that it has been good for consumers, but there are some real questions about exactly how you value, say, a degraded flight experience or one that requires more connections, or one where, you know, the terms of you never get to change something unless you pay some incredibly exorbitant fee or things like that. So, you know, measuring the quality is a very, I think, a contested area here, and I think that's also a theme of the book, you know, is that a lot of times there are measurements that are put out there, statistics that are put out there, and the problem becomes, you know, really looking and digging into them. There's often not the patience among a lot of folks to do that. So that, I think, is the theme of the treatment of AAA ratings and subprime mortgages. But, yeah.
I think that's maybe, to me, one of the most fascinating things about your book. I mean, aside of apart from our general understanding of the quantity of media, which, you know, is already, and thanks to Snowden and people like him, a little bit more obvious to the general public, but you're talking about the processing of the media. So it's like it's the ultimate problem even when you do statistical analysis. It's kind of endogeneity, but it sounds fancy, but it's very simple, really. The notion that Frank Pasquale is in his book, which I should remind is The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information, shows us also how, based on our data, the information that we receive, is different. So we're getting fed different information that we continue to accumulate. So this is really a manipulation, possibly through algorithms, like you were saying. It's not about certain bad people. When you have a bad institution, it will attract bad people invariably. And if you put a good people in it, it's a waste of time. But that's a little bit of another matter. But you explain in the book how the processing of all this data that's collected about us, that is recommending us way of life, will determine our coverage. Like my personal nightmare was so well articulated by you about health insurance, right? That if I look up something on diabetes for my parents who are visiting me now, pretty soon I'll be tagged as potentially, right, more expensive and potentially be charged more for health insurance. So it can be very kind of touch home. I want to bring it back there. It could hurt us big time.
Yes. And it's so problematic too, because and this personalization, I mean, and this is why this dialogue between reputation and search is so important to me. I mean, the reputation in the book being how I am viewed by the world, and search being how I view the world increasingly, how the technological mediations between myself and, you know, representations of what's going on in the world. And I think that, you know, when you think about how strange it is that you can just be looking for information on diabetes and all of a sudden have that play into an algorithm as to whether you get credit, whether you get life insurance, and perhaps even at some point affecting your health insurance too. I mean, one thing in the book was it uses an example from before the Affordable Care Act, which was, you know, at that time the individual insurance market was a complete free-for-all. And now at least there is some regulation with respect to not discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions.
It's a little harder.
It's a little harder.
Oh, yeah, but no, go ahead. What was your skepticism of that? Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, we're not going to go into it further.
I mean.
A little bit or something.
Yeah, given that I'm someone with a pre-existing condition, and I think Trudy Lieberman, in the issue of the July issue of Harper's Magazine, talks about this a little bit, that yes, insurance companies can't, discriminate outright against people with pre-existing conditions. But the insurance plans that they do get or are offered to them, make it very difficult for them to deal with their pre-existing conditions. So just to give you an example, none of the, plans under the Affordable Care Act, you know, from the highest levels to the lowest levels, offer one of the essential medicines that I need. That medicine is completely out of network and I have to pay for that out of pocket. So it, you know, yes, I have access to health insurance, but I still at the end of the day have very spotty health care. And you know, the access to the insurance may assist me in some sort of catastrophe, but with a pre-existing condition, the point is to do the preventative care to manage it so that you don't get to that catastrophic point. But you know, the Affordable Care Act doesn't allow you to do that. And Trudy Lieberman even argues that it doesn't even allow you to get preventative care either. You know, so I'm quite skeptical.
No, it's highly contested, but of course, you know, in public sphere, we argue. I mean, again, just for our listeners, in case they are out there, there is, we're arguing at this, not from the silliness of the Obamacare pro and con that we are duped with very directly through, mainstream media propaganda, but about the nuts and bolts of it. So it's a kind of an internal, we all agree surely that we actually need, or probably that we need a highly revised healthcare system.
Right.
We're just concerned. I mean, it's to the point, though. This is the question between, what, broadly speaking, liberals and radicals, you could say, right? This notion, could you regulate all of that information? And I know this is like, it's everybody's picking on you, Frank, for this, and you probably knew it when you finished the book, but you had to do it anyway. I totally feel you on that. You had to try and stab at how to regulate it. It's not really your main focus. But can you even regulate it just like the health insurance might have had even a better health reform with better regulation, shall we say, but it can be circumvented, perhaps even particularly easily with the accumulation of privately held or shared between government and private interest data. So the question is, could regulation actually, even if we manage to make government accountable and good about it, bring us the change we need, given the predistribution of power? I mean, will these corporations be willing to give up this treasure trove? I mean, it could be their entire wealth in the next, you know, in the rest of the century.
Well, you know, I mean, I do think that there is room for skepticism. There's room for worry about the administrability of any sort of regulation. You know, and I'll just give a really concrete example that will put this into, you know, there's something I've been struggling with actually in follow-on work after the book. So under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, people have a right to remove bankruptcies from their credit report 10 years after the bankruptcy, right? And under expungement law, juveniles, you know, have a right to, or juveniles have a right to have their court record sealed, and under expungement law, there's some things you can get expunged from your criminal record, et cetera. But now the problem is, well, if the first Google result on a person's name is the bankruptcy they had 12 years ago, you know, if the first hit on their name is the crime that, you know, was allegedly expunged, what good does that do them? The expungement or the Fair Credit Reporting Act don't seem to really help very much. Well, at least with respect to the bankruptcy, the European Union has had a response which is called the right to be forgotten, yeah, which is, you know, not really an accurate description of the right. I mean, it really ought to be called a right to be delisted from major information dossier creating entities like Google, like search engines. And there, this guy sued because he said basically, look, I had financial troubles in 1998. It's still showing up as my first Google hit in 2015 or 2009 was when he sued. And I want this off the Google results on my name because, frankly, it's really damaging my ability to get a job or to do other, you know, to move on in life. And this European Court of Justice said, yeah, we agree with you. And Google is going to have to look at different entries of people that have presents a dossier on people based on a search on their name. And if the information is irrelevant, excessive, unfair, untrue, there's all these sort of different categories it could fall into, and there's not a countervailing public interest in the information, it's going to have to take it off of those results about you. You bring up something like that in the U.S., and people are just shocked, and they say, oh, my God, you know, the First Amendment, this would be terrible, it's censoring the media. But it's not really censoring the media, because it still exists in that newspaper. If someone really was obsessed, they could find this information about the person. You know, they just have to go to individual newspapers and search for it. But I think that, you know, that type of right to be forgotten, that's a really interesting example of lawmakers and judges stepping up to the plate and saying, look, we're going to protect people's privacy. And there's so far, I think there have been about 300,000 requests to have stuff taken down. And some people get rejected. Politicians, when they ask for their scandals taken down, they just get rejected. It said, you know, if you're a politician, there's a public interest in knowing about your scandal. Mm-hmm. But, a woman whose husband was murdered 20 years ago, and the story of the murder of her husband is the first hit on her name on Google now, she applied and she was given the right to be forgotten. That's taken down now off of Google results on her name. Mm-hmm. So I sort of feel like the question is, and here this gets to a political economy labor question, which is, you know, a lot of people at Google and a lot of the technophiles and the tech press say, oh my God, this is going to slow down innovative companies. And my view is, you know, following Adrian Chen's recent article on moderators that was just in the New York Times, I think, like a couple days ago, is he says, well, the new Internet business model is to make as much money as possible with hiring as few people as possible. Mm-hmm. And to me, what the right to be forgotten does is it says, hey, wait a second, search engines, you're creating a lot of collateral damage with what you're doing, so hire some people to clean it up. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is like, that's what we got to be able to say to Silicon Valley, is like, if you're going to be creating collateral damage, let's not just pretend that like search engines are just this natural aspect of our world. Let's hire people to clean up the collateral damage.
So I had a particular question. So you talk about the way that this information is processed. You talk about how it's collected. But what I somewhat found missing from the book is the particularly as it pertains to places like Google, Facebook and Twitter, is really what they are, is what Richard Stallman calls proprietary, or what they deal in is, or what they offer is proprietary software, or software that exploits and controls the user. So my question to you is that, regulation may be a start, but what do you say about, say, changing the structure of these companies, or changing the structure of software and replacing proprietary software with
could we compete?
Free and,
I mean, is Elo good?
Free and open.
You know what I mean? I mean, could we compete it? Could there be a social network that provides sufficient interconnectivity and usefulness without, you know, raiding our private information? Oh dear. Wait, okay. So let's hold to that thought. We have to go to station announcements, and we just stay together after a couple of minutes.
Okay.
And we'll be right back with some more Punkonomics, broadcasting live out of WPRK, Winter Park, Florida, the voice of Rollins College, and the best in basement radio. We'll be right back.